Hey, it's John. I want to share with you a little bit about Chuck Norris's morning kick. I started taking it every morning when I get up and I feel great. It's a new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. It tastes good and gives me the energy I need to start the day, both physically and mentally. It also gives me that initial boost I need without the sugar crash that orange juice gives me. Many of us don't eat enough green vegetables, and this is a good way to remedy that. I know I've noticed a difference, and maybe you will too. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris today. All right, we're live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. It is a wonderful summer day. And I'm assuming it's a wonderful summer day in Tennessee. I'm in New York right now, but I have two guests with me from Tennessee. I'm not talking about the Southern Baptist Convention, guys. I'm talking about the weather. I hope that's true. You at least have that, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Trying to start on a positive note. You're not helping me. I know it is a discouraging day, and I want to get both of you to kind of give your input on this. We have Jeff Wright, who is the pastor at Midway Baptist Church. He was just at the Southern Baptist Convention over the last 3 days. We have David Morrill, who writes for Protestia, and you can check out protestia.com if you want more info. Well, thanks, guys. I know your time's valuable. I appreciate you joining me and we being willing to discuss this. I thought maybe what we would do is play some of the clips and then have you guys explain what happened today, because I know there's a lot of confusion out there with what did and didn't happen. I was even confused about some things. I thought at first that the law amendment had passed when I saw the results, and then I didn't realize it took 2/3. So let's start here with you, David. You made a motion from the floor, and I'll let you explain, or you wanted, I don't even know if that's the right word, you wanted to correct or edit a motion that you had made. So here's what you said.
Yeah, I'm David Morrill, messenger from Applewood Baptist Church, Wheat Ridge, Colorado. I wanted to speak against my previous motion being ruled out of order on the basis that it was getting funds from the cooperative program, because it's my understanding that
So there's not a motion on the floor, so you can't really speak against something. If what you're trying to do is raise a point of order, or if what you're trying to do, I'm sorry, is to appeal the decision of the chair,
yes,
you can do that.
Okay.
Is that what you'd like to do?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out why. Yes, that's what I'm trying to do.
Okay. Very good. All right. So state your appeal, and what you're going to need to do here in stating your appeal is state why my ruling that it was out of order is wrong. Okay?
Yeah, I suppose I would say it's out of order because the original commissioning of the Sex Abuse Task Force in 2021 allocated cooperative program funds for that task force. So I'm not sure why my task force seeking financial accountability cannot also allocate cooperative program funds.
Okay.
It seems like it's not an even standard at this point.
Stand at ease for just a second, if you will.
Let's skip ahead a little bit.
I appreciate your patience.
Let's see here. Okay, so I'm not going to play the rest of it just because I think that's the gist of it anyway. Long story short, the vote happened and you lost that vote. What were you trying to do there, David?
Well, so the day before yesterday, I had presented a motion basically to commission a task force very similar to the sex abuse task force that they commissioned in 2021, but to investigate how over the last few years all that process went down. Because I mean, I know both of you have done research and investigation into this, and we've chronicled it over the last few years and seen that a lot of the narrative behind why all of it started, as far as this, you know, what I like to call the SBC's sex abuse adventure at this point, how all of it started, how it went, how the financial accountability was sort of lost. justice was lost. So I wanted to commission a task force to investigate that and also to investigate Rachel Den Hollander's involvement in all of it, because I think that she was a big part of why there was a lot of guilt and pressure and confusion among forwarded that motion to the executive committee yesterday. And then apparently Barber decided it was out of order because I had mentioned at the end of the resolution that CP allocation would basically fund this task force. And I copied and pasted that language directly from the 2021 motion that Grant Gaines offered to start us on this whole sex abuse task force adventure, thinking, okay, I'll do the same thing. If it works for him, it should work for me. And apparently Bart thought otherwise.
Jeff, is that because I kept seeing this throughout the convention as I watched it? Was Bart a bad parliamentarian?
Bart's not a bad parliamentarian. He's a biased parliamentarian. He knows the rules. He knows the language, and I don't feel a burden to be nice to Bart. Bart does a fairly good job running the meeting, but he clearly runs it with a bent. And David's bent cuts against popular fashions, and so it's out of order, despite what language you may, use that's been successful in the past.
Okay, so we have a situation where there's different weights and measures being applied, and what worked for someone on the left is not working for you. And that's sad, because that would have been a really good thing. And I think, just to set the tone for everyone, I know I said it's a nice day and I tried to be nice and everything, but you're going to go through a series of defeats for conservatives. There's really no other way to put it. This was not good for conservatives this year. In fact, worse than I even thought it would go. And I thought it wasn't going to go too well. So we're going to go through it. And then at the end, I'll ask you guys, if David, you're still with us, because I know you got to catch a flight. Just, what do you think should be the response going forward? So you can think about how we're going. All right, next, let's see. I don't want to listen to Bart anymore. Let's talk about this. This is Albert Mohler, and he is responding. What was he, before I play the clip, what was he responding to exactly? There was something against him and a few other people about sexual abuse, right?
Yeah, someone had made a motion the prior day to censure Bart Barber, Al Mohler, and I believe Lifeway, maybe the Lifeway president, the organization or something, because of their support for the amicus brief that the SBC signed on to with relation to the, and Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong about this, you might know a little closer than me, but to the SBC had signed on basically to an amicus brief indicating their disagreement with extending the statute of limitations for third parties to sex abuse lawsuits. And so the SBC, I would have argued, was being fiscally responsible to do that. I thought it was the right decision, and I thought Bart supporting it was actually the right decision. But of course, he caved as soon as public pressure changed. He caved and apologized for it and all of this. Somebody wanted another pound of flesh from these guys over it.
All right.
Jump in, John. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an interesting example of how the parliamentary bias works in the SBC, and that you have operatives involved. So the original censure, which is part of a very unique clause in the SBC bylaws, it you won't find it in any other entities' organizing documents. The original censure was aimed at Bart, Al, and Mandrell, who's the head of Lifeway. It was brought out of committee stunningly, because for years and years attending this, they will not bring anything out that names specific names. They brought this out, and it immediately lifts your eyebrow. What's going on here? Well, as soon as we got in the room today, there was an immediate move to exclude Bart Barber. And why that matters is he did what David said. He caved, and he did what the fashions of the moment want. So really what this was to do was to isolate Al Mohler, to put him through a public struggle session. Al cares very much about his legacy, about how he's perceived in the annals of Southern Baptist history. And this was an attempt to penalize him for daring to break with the fashionable winds of the abuse witch hunt and subject him to public shame. And so it went on, and then Al got up to say what David said. Basically, this was in the best interest of Southern Baptists.
Well, let me play that for everyone. And Jeff, I don't know. You might want to just check your connection there. I'm not sure what's going on with your mic. Here's Al Mohler on the floor.
Those in favor have it.
The decision here.
And brothers and sisters, I hesitate to think what the Southern Baptist Convention is going to look like if this is what we're going to do, meeting by meeting. I am here with Keith Daniel, who is the chairman of the Board of Trustees, and also with Josh Powell, immediate past chairman of the Board of Trustees. The Southern Baptist Theological Seminary has nothing to hide, and I'm trying to think about how we can serve Southern Baptists best in this very moment. I think one thing you need to know is that presidents of your institutions are not the lawyers for your institutions, and that's for good reason. We have lawyers as general counsel hired by the Board of Trustees. They make legal decisions. The Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, in serving Southern Baptists, has avoided scandal by following the advice of auditors, accountants, and attorneys and not violating that advice. We have the responsibility to act righteously and to act in ways that are consistent with the Southern Baptist Convention. We too stand for the cause of defending the defenseless, and we believe the best way to do that is through the proper application of the rule of law. Our Board of Trustees hires the attorneys. The attorneys, on behalf of the institution, plot and they undertake legal strategy. They represent us. You do not want the presidents of your institutions flouting the advice of the general counsel that your boards of trustees hire. That's what you want us to do. Otherwise, chaos will ensue. We have nothing to hide. We have acted righteously in this situation. In the case at hand here, the Supreme Court of the Commonwealth of Kentucky said that the issue had not only been wrongly decided, but was unconstitutional. We believe that justice and righteousness will come by the proper application of the rule of law. And so I just want to tell you that I'm pleased to answer as president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, two board chairmen behind me. This is our plea. Hold your institutions accountable, but to following the very rules we are given. Thank you, Mr.
Okay, so two questions, David. First of all, did the Southern Baptist Convention follow Al Mohler's advice there, or did they censure him? And then secondly, he's referring to a case, I think I covered it, in Kentucky. I can't remember all the specifics of it, but that must be the amicus brief that we're talking about here.
Yeah, they didn't censure him, but not because... not because they voted against the censure, but because they ruled the motion to censure out of order. So originally the Bart or whoever had ruled that the motion was in order and it was going to go to the floor for debate and discussion. But then they allowed the messengers to overrule that, and the messengers overruled the motion being in order, which meant the motion was out of order, which meant it never came to a censure.
Okay. Is that a little bit of a victory, I suppose? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought so. But Bart came out smelling like a rose, to be honest, because Bart was able to both get credit for allowing a motion to censure him to get to the floor to be debated by the messengers, and then have the messengers say, "No, that's okay, Bart. You know, we respect that. We didn't even have to vote on whether to censure him or not." Now, I don't know about Jeff, but I disagreed with the entire thing. I didn't think Bart should have been censured at all. I think he actually did the right thing. I think apologizing for it was the wrong thing. I think, you know, caving to the pressure of the zeitgeist was the wrong thing, and that following the law and doing what he was supposed to do and protecting the Southern Baptist Convention's, financial, assets and the giving of the churches was the right thing to do.
Yeah, that's my exact same read. Yeah, that's perfectly right. And what Al said, even in that clip, I know we've all got gripes with Al, but the chaos that he talked about is exactly what this investigation has produced. He's right. And you can see the double standard there, right? So if you don't call the cops on a sex abuse claim, you're a violent abuse cover up, right? But if you do things right legally and they still don't like you, well, that was the wrong move. How dare you follow the law, right? We have a higher standard to meet. It's an impossible burden of expectation, but that's what the winds of the fashions of the SBC are currently insisting on.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that's what the Lifeway president, he actually argued that the reason that the messenger should reject the censure is because the person that brought the motion never went to him privately. He actually pulled the Matthew 18 card.
Yes. I didn't play it, but we can't play everything. I think it's rich that Al Mohler's the one that's going through this, given that he's the one who validated the Houston Chronicle story when it first came out. He's the one that legitimized Jennifer Lyell's story, said it was abuse. David Sills is an abuser. These are the early and the first penetrations of Me Too into the Southern Baptist Convention. Mohler was leading the charge, and now he's upset about where this went. And I just find that rich. So, all right, let's go to the next clip. See what we got here. I think this might be, oh no, this is an important one. Okay. This is Tom Askell talking about the ERLC and disbanding it, which was a great motion to bring up. Let's just disband the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission.
Tom Askell, Grace Baptist Church, Cape Coral, Florida. Bylaw 25 is called, in part, abolishing entities. It instructs messengers how to do this by stating, quote, "No entity shall be discontinued without a majority vote at two successive annual sessions of the convention." Obviously, this bylaw anticipates that there may be times when the SBC entities will need to be discontinued. Such a time has come. For the last 8 years, the ERLC has become increasingly distant from the values and concerns of the churches that finance it. I, along with countless other pastors, have voiced our concerns to executive trustees and trustees over positions, actions, and inactions of the ERLC. On August 1, 2018, I was appalled when the ERLC produced and released a professional video arguing that animal rights is a pro-life issue. Though the video was finally taken down, I'm left to wonder, why was cooperative program money ever used to produce such a video? Many of us have pled with the ERLC to work for legislation that grants preborn children equal protection under the law, but they refused to do so. In 2021, messengers voted a resolution that says, quote, "As Southern Baptists, we will engage with God's help in establishing equal justice and protection for the preborn according to the authority of God's word, as well as local and federal laws." Yet 1 year later, the president of the ERLC issued an open letter to state lawmakers in which he and others stated that they represent, quote, "tens of millions of pro-life men, women, and children across the country." And they went on to say, "Let us be clear. We state unequivocally that we do not support any measures seeking to criminalize or punish women, and we stand firmly opposed to include such penalties in legislation." That letter killed the bill in Louisiana, which would have been the first law in the United States to completely outlaw abortion. It's time for us to call the ERLC to become accountable to the churches who pay for it. Bylaw 25 wisely does not allow for the discontinuation of any entity with just one vote. It takes two positive votes for two successive years. Adopting this motion today will not eliminate the ERLC today, but it will send a clear message that the churches of the SBC are deeply concerned about their mission drift. We're often told by our leaders that the local church is the headquarters of the SBC. It's time that the ERLC hears from headquarters. A positive vote will give them one full year to make a course correction. Please support this vote.
Okay, I know that was long. We're going to play, though, a little bit of Brent Leatherwood's response, and so we can contrast. This is the response from the ERLC.
Phone 8A, can you please state your name your church and your point of order.
Thank you, Mr. President. My name is Brent Leatherwood. I am a messenger from Brentwood Baptist Church in Brentwood, Tennessee, and I am a deacon of that church, and that means I am called to serve.
Dr. Leatherwood,
also,
you're going to be able to continue to speak, but let me explain why, because everybody's watched me recognize you and ask what your point of order is. Actually, the urgent request button was pushed because under Article 12, he has a privileged place to be able to reply and respond to this motion. I'm sorry that I interrupted you to do that, but I just wanted to help everybody understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. So as I was saying, I view myself as a servant, and I bring that servant heart to the other role that I occupy, which is president of your Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. And we read in Proverbs that a gentle answer turns away wrath. That is certainly my prayer for what I'm about to respond to. I hope that my response comports to that. The history of this 100-year-old commission has always found it at the leading edge of issues, sometimes speaking for our churches, sometimes speaking with our churches. Examples such as civil rights, the sanctity of life, the protection of conscience, or responding to abuse in the church. Now, our brother likes to bring up an issue from a different era, well before I was president of this organization, back in 2018. Look, that's from a different time. That video was taken down nearly immediately because the organization realized it had made a mistake. And so none of us is perfect, but we did take that down, and we accepted responsibility for it. But in all that this organization strives to do, it strives to be faithful to Scripture, faithful to what the Lord calls us to do, faithful to serve our churches. And we are in a great hour of need in our culture and in our convention. Division and anger are plentiful. Voices are wanting to tear down with false assertions and half-truths that are everywhere. To eliminate an entity whose voice is needed now as much as ever would be the wrong move. No, this commission speaks truth with a capital T, and the grace that it also speaks with is exactly what is needed now. I would ask this body to reject this motion.
Okay, I can't take it anymore. I got to stop it. All right. I'm going to let Jeff and then we'll go to David respond to that, because I know that the vote came and Tom Askell did not. He was not able to get his motion passed.
Yeah. So Brent's just a liar. He just lies whenever he opens his mouth. So there were two items that Tom cited. One was that stupid, you know, animals pro-life video. The other was the more, infinitely more atrocious killing of the abortion bill. Brent was on staff at the ERLC at the time that the ERLC produced that video. That video came down and was left up for a long time, but it did come down when people online held them accountable. And so there was no immediate takedown. They had to wait for a roar to come from social media to take that down. Brent had his hands in that. He's Russell Moore runs the ERLC through Leatherwood by wire anytime he wants to. They're hand in glove. And he never touched the atrocious assault on human life that he was the author of as the head of the ERLC. And then, you know, what we didn't get to see there is Tom did respond. Brent went on to impugn Tom's character, attribute political motivations to him. You know, we hear so much about the hateful rhetoric that comes from online voices. When our entity heads get any opportunity to speak where they can't be spoken back to, they're the most vicious people in the world. And thankfully, Tom had a chance to highlight that for the messengers and say, hey, look what he's doing here. I've been in the room now for a lot of moves to do something about ending the ERLC. And so it failed again, but it fails by a smaller margin every time. And, you know, I don't know what kind of snowball effect the convention will have this year. More conservative churches leave every year. But if enough hang around, Brent's going to reap what he's sowing. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, David.
Yeah, it's true. Although we can't ever see it when it happens, the word gets out. We can't forget that the messengers that are there, and this is I would argue the further that it gets away from the South, the more that this happens. But the messengers that are there tilt towards those who are institutionally invested. They're Lifeway employees. They're NAM employees. They're people that have a financial, very personal and financial stake in the size and influence and resources of the convention. And the word gets around about who the troublemakers are. So they know Founders Ministry and Tom Askell, and they know instinctively if he's standing up to do something, it's probably something they're supposed to oppose. And or if Jeff stands up there, or now if I stand up there, you know, we're all put in that same sort of bucket of conservative deplorables with a lot of the messengers. And that's not to say that there aren't conservatives on the floor and people that, I mean, we can see by still the majority that wanted to ratify the law amendment, even though it didn't get quite there. I guess we'll talk about that in a bit. But we can see there are conservatives on the floor, but there's also just a big – there's so much institutional weight in not changing anything. And the more that we debate and the more that we argue and the more contentious stuff gets, people have a pretty – especially regular folks, they have a really limited – appetite for that. And the platform knows it. They know if they muck things up and they can get it to be a lot of hemming and hawing and divisiveness, and that it always favors the status quo. It always favors not changing something.
Gotcha. Jeff, you had something more?
Yeah, just real quick. I'm assuming your audience is pretty well informed on this, John, but what happens with the annual meeting is that for a lot of the attendees, this is a paid vacation by their churches. And so they have no interest whatsoever in doing what we've actually come to do. They want to get out of any business session as quickly as possible and get to a AAA ball game or, you know, the restaurant they've got reservations at, go see sites. I sit behind multiple men and their wives and listen to multiple wives say, oh, why are we doing this? Why can't we wrap this up? This is exhausting. And it ends up, just like David said, this tremendous inertia against actually doing anything meaningful. I honestly don't know how to fix it because churches just send these people thinking they're here to do something serious, and that's just not what's happening.
All right. Well, on that note, let's go to the next item here on the agenda. So I'm going to skip past the vote, and I think, let's see. Okay, so this I won't play the video for, but just another negative thing. Michael Clary and Brad Groves. I don't know if either of you want to talk to this, but Brad Groves beat Michael Clary for the SBC first vice president. Michael Clary was the conservative, as I understand it. Graves, was not. And so not only did the presidency go to someone who is more, we'll say, progressive than we would like, but also the vice president. Is anything to say on this?
You read it correctly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's go to the next item then. We got I got to play the clip. So there's more that could be said than just one clip. But let me play this kind of representative clip from Dean and Sarah's convention sermon.
We're all just looking at our phones, and we hear this voice behind us. It's the gate agent coming through, and they're saying, step to the left, please. Step to the left, please. Step to the left, please. And as we're looking at our phones, all of us, not even thinking about it, I never even saw the person. We just went like this, all of us, and stepped to the left as a person went right past us. Messengers and guests this morning, the world wants us to step to the theological left. And we must always be cautious, Southern Baptists, that it will never happen on our watch. It is such a temptation. Perhaps the sin that so easily entangles us in this era of Southern Baptist history is being so concerned about what others think about us, especially online. A side street warning to us is not to become enamored by what Joe Rigney calls the progressive gaze, with this figurative progressive that for some reason we want so badly to see us as either cool or accepting or on the right side of history or not too conservative or definitely not one of those kind of Christians that Twitter and podcasts tell us about, lingers on our shoulder. And we can so easily just step to the left as we stare at our phones to appease, impress, and get a thumbs up just for the moment. Do they think I'm too conservative? Do they see me as in the middle, third way enough? There are other things you may sweat, such as making sure you're not seen as a liberal by SBC hobby watchdog Twitter. The answer to this is not to move to an extra biblical right, but rather to stay on the faithful road of following Jesus, fixing our eyes on him, and submitting ourselves under the authority of his word. It is so easy to get entangled and start running down a side street, chasing clout rather than chasing Christ.
My name is Spence Shelton.
Okay, we'll stop there then, and I'll get your reactions. Jeff, you want to go first, and then David?
Yeah, man, I mean, I know Dean. I've known Dean for a long time. Dean, that right there was a giant gaslight. Dean is the theological left, and he appropriates the language of the people that he thinks are on the right, like Joe Rigney, to just advance the Kellerism he was ostensibly decrying. That's third wayism right there. He's trying to marshal Joe Rigney as an authority on his side. And by the way, Joe Rigney today went out of his way online to make sure that everybody knew Dean was his buddy. This is the same kind of hijinks. And Dean, by preaching that sermon, Dean, what's being signaled is Dean is in the on-deck box to be the next SBC president. He's a J.D. Greer kind of clone of a clone. He's everything that he's, you know, ostensibly saying he's not right there. And what he wants to do is trick the messengers and think, oh, this is the faithful guy walking the road down the middle of ditches, when he's the voice saying, step left, step left, step left.
As far as specifics go on Dean, I remember he was the guy, one of the guys who was really covering for Adam Greenway when Enemies Within the Church, premiered, and Adam Greenway attacked Enemies Within the Church. Dean and Sarah was right there saying how faithful Adam Greenway was. I wonder, though, and I can't remember, because I was surprised when I saw this, too. Like, what are some other examples? Because I'm like, I know that guy's more on the left. Because I know, even in years past, I know I've tangled with him. I know others, A.D. Robles has tangled with him quite a bit on things. And I was surprised to hear him kind of do what you just said, Jeff. So what makes you say he's on the left more?
Oh, he's a thoroughgoing company man. He'll never take a position that's contrary to the SBC elites. That's one thing. He's been in bed with them since the first time I met him on Russell Moore's ERLC. I mean, recently, Jared Moore's been laying him out for his position on homosexuality. You know, it's the classic, oh, it's not really a sin to want to sodomize someone. It's just if you act on it. You know, anytime you scratch Dean, blue liberalism rolls out. But, you know, above all, he's fundamentally committed to using the entities of the SBC to climb his career ladder, and that's always going to involve him compromising toward the fashions of the world.
David, what do you say?
No, I agree with Jeff. It's a lot of these guys, they end up doing what we call being website orthodox, where so they, like Dean, can get up in this sermon and basically for half the sermon plant the generic seed of we're going to follow Christ and not follow the world. Follow Christ, follow the world. He's not getting specific yet. He's just getting the framework out there. He's building this empty shell of moral imperative for the messengers to say, well, of course, you all want to follow Christ, right? You know, you don't want to follow the world. You want to follow Christ. But he hasn't put any meaning into it yet. That comes later after the crowd of, you know, the messengers in this case, or a congregation, for instance, is invested. And they say, of course, we want to follow Christ. Then he starts to describe what that is. And by the time he's describing what it is, they're already invested. And this is a typical bait and switch kind of a technique. But in Dean's case, Jeff's right. He has been on the record multiple times. Jared Moore has approached this and other, I'm sure protesting, we've talked about it at some point, basically supporting side B SSA, LGBTQ, capitulated Christianity, that kind of a thing. He's in there. So it wasn't surprising to me to hear him say things that conservatives would be like, yeah, that's pretty good. But he, you know, then he slips that little poison. Like, I don't know what he meant, for instance, by the overreacted right, or however he said it. Like, don't go too far to the right in your attempt not to be left. I'm not sure what he meant by that,
but it was that.
Yeah, of course not. Couldn't be.
Yeah. All right. Let's see what else we got here. And what was this? I'm trying to remember what this. Oh, this. Let's see here. And I, for some reason, I captured this. I thought it was significant. Oh, this is the law amendment stuff. All right. So let's just play this real quick. This is the argument first against the law amendment and then for the law amendment. Here it is.
University Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. The question before us today is not whether or not we're complementarian. That's clear. The question is not, do we believe the Bible? That's also clear. We are complementarian. We believe the scripture. The question is this amendment necessary for our convention to respond when churches in our convention act in a way contrary to our complementarian doctrine? We showed last year we have an effective mechanism. It allows us to act with conviction, and unity when it comes to this issue. Last year, we removed two different churches, one really big, like a mega church, one normative size. This year, we removed an institutional legacy church. Y'all, we have shown that the mechanisms we currently have are sufficient to deal with this question. Listen, the last thing I want to say is I believe that we need to act in unity as a convention. The other three amendments that we made by raised ballot, and it was an overwhelmingly majority referendum on this issue. So I want to risk something, if you will, to my fellow brothers and sisters, because this has been weighing on me a whole lot. Would you be willing, if this goes to a written ballot, to see that as our message that we're not unified when it comes to this issue? If we all raise overwhelming majority, let it be so. But if not, if this goes to a written ballot, maybe that's our signal that we are not unified as Southern Baptists, and why would we go forward with something that we are not unified in? I love that we are unified in the Great Commission. We are unified in our biblical convictions. Let us go forward in those and vote down this amendment. Thank you, Mr. President.
Okay. Also at microphone 10A, but this time to speak in favor of the amendment. Please state your name, your church, and your argument.
Thank you, Mr. President. My name is Mike Law, and I'm a messenger from Arlington Baptist Church. I rise to support this motion because it is faithful to God's inerrant word. Southern Baptists love the Bible and long to be faithful to the Bible. In 1987, there were 18 women serving as pastors in the Southern Baptist churches. Last year, we learned there were over 1,800. This is a problem. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 12 to 14, the all-wise God says that a woman ought not teach or exercise authority over a man, terms associated with the pastoral office. Our culture may see this prohibition as harsh, but our God is all-wise, and he wrote his word for the flourishing of both men and women. Our Baptist faith and message agrees. While both men and women are gifted for service in the church, the office of pastor, elder, overseer is limited to men as qualified by Scripture. Let's be exceptionally clear. We gladly celebrate the myriads of women who serve the church in many essential ways. We are so grateful for these godly sisters. This amendment is not about women in ministry. It's specifically about women in the pastoral office. Last year, we rightly stood on the truth of Scripture and adopted this amendment. Many things have changed since last year, but one thing has not changed. God's word remains the same. The Bible still teaches that the office of pastor is reserved for qualified men. Other denominations have failed here. Even this year, we have seen the United Methodists collapse into unbiblical chaos. Brothers and sisters, for the glory of God, we must side with Scripture. Last year, we voted for biblical faithfulness. Yesterday, we voted for biblical faithfulness. Today, let us vote for biblical faithfulness. Tomorrow and every day, let us vote for biblical faithfulness until we hand this convention over to the next generation to vote for biblical faithfulness. This amendment is faithful to Scripture. This amendment makes clear that the pastoral office is reserved for biblically qualified men. This amendment announces our unity in God's word to build churches according to God's design. In conclusion, I encourage you to vote yes for this amendment, to adopt this amendment, and stand with the unchanging word of our good and wise God. And I move the previous question.
All right. Well, there are the results. So there were more people who actually did vote for it, but it was only 61%, which is not enough. So we'll start with Jeff and then go to David on the law amendment issue. Jeff, there's a lot of questions coming in right now about, you know, how did this happen? How in the world did the SBC not pass this? Drew Smith says, can y'all explain why anyone voted against this? I really don't understand.
Yeah, well, you heard in that setup from the man speaking against the motion, you know, we have to assume that we're complementary. We have to assume that we're biblical. And once those are taken off the table, then, you know, it's just a matter of, are we doing this right? So what's happened here is the SBC, the backstory is the SBC has seen leaning into DEI-style policies as the way to maintain their size, which involves ethnic congregations that may have female pastors. That's been the selling point, asking these churches to come in. They thought they didn't, you know, the SBC elites didn't think they'd ever have to, deal with that. They just thought they could do that and nobody would care, as I'll illustrate in just a moment. But now the law amendment has put a spotlight on it, and they found out there is actually a will within the Southern Baptist Convention remaining to hold the line on this matter, and the UMC was providentially a good illustration of that. So the game has been to say, well, our mechanisms work. You heard the guy say it. We voted out Rick Warren. We voted out Fern Creek. Right before, yesterday, we voted out FBC Alexandria with a female pastor in it, right? So the mechanism works. What he did not mention is that FBC Alexandria, by their own reporting, has been in the SBC for 44 years. Colin Smothers from the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood got up when the Alexandria motion was before us and said, hey, Credentials Committee, how long have you known about the situation with FBC Alexandria? And you could hear the back pedaling. They were never going to answer that question. They got away from that as soon as they possibly could. What they did is trot Alexandria out there and say, see, look, the mechanisms work, as a way to distract from, no, the mechanisms actually don't work. You're just now in an awkward position where we're expecting you to. So how did people vote against it? Well, here's what I'm going to tell you. I naively thought going to a ballot vote was going to be in our favor, because I thought it would put on the record objective data about how much consensus is in the SBC about this. What actually happened, John, and David, check me on this. What actually happened is that men who would not have voted against the amendment had they been required to raise their hands publicly in the privacy of a private ballot were happy to express their egalitarian leanings. And that's where the 30-some-odd percentage of people went against the law amendment. If we had had a ballot waving, they would have felt a public burden, because the world is watching and they're constantly being groomed to think that PR is all that matters. They would have raised their hands like they did last year, where the vote was much more significant in terms of percentage in favor. But this year, because it could be a private matter with a private ballot, we got to see a little bit more clearly how deep the rot in the SBC is. We needed 66%. We got 61%.
David, do you agree with that? That's what happened? Because I was surprised, too, that last year, wasn't it like 85% or 90% that voted for the law amendment? And then to see it plummet to that number is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it was much more significant. And I had actually, I was joking with Jeff, like we ran into each other at lunch. And we both went up to Mike Law just to sort of commiserate. He seemed in good spirits. He thinks that there's still momentum for this issue, so that was nice. But I was joking with Jeff. I said, hey, when you get on John's stream, I'm just gonna be behind you and jump out or something. But we're in different buildings now, so I couldn't do that. I generally agree with that. I think that the reason, and I agree with Jeff's analysis, that going to a ballot versus a hand raised vote allowed people to not have to they didn't have to publicly stand against banning women pastors. They could do it secretly, and I'm not sure that it was their secret egalitarianism as much as it was their belief, founded or not, that ratifying the law amendment would cause the SBC to lose hundreds and hundreds of churches. And so the institutionalism of it all, that plays a big factor. A lot of the folks that are there are really invested, like I said before, in the size of the SBC. And so if, you know, I put this on X a little bit earlier, the hundreds of churches, maybe thousands of churches in the SBC that have women pastors either by name or by function is our dirty little secret. But as long as they keep, you know, participating in the cooperative program and all the funding and things like that, we don't really particularly care if they're doctrinally faithful. As long as they keep the coffers filled, you know, we don't want to risk kicking them out by getting too doctrinally, you know, insistent and specific.
So I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the last issue I wanted to discuss with you is the issue of the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. And we have a new president, obviously, Clint Pressley, who is the only one I really focused on as far as I didn't want people to vote for him. And it's because I thought he was going to win early on, or he was probably going to be the kind of center left, keep the ship going in the same direction, favorite pick. And it's interesting to me that we had two conservatives. We had Jared Moore and who's the other guy? I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name.
David Allen.
Thank you. So we had David Allen, and with the first two rounds of voting, they were both eliminated. Jared Moore was eliminated in the first round. David Allen was eliminated in the second round. So by the time we got to the final round, we had, from my understanding, it was two guys who were a little more on the left who were running against each other. So there wasn't much of a choice. Now, Clint Pressley, some guys, it's interesting. I'm already seeing people out there. Colin Smothers is one of them, right? Colin Smothers is out there congratulating, and I think he said something positive about, like, Clint Pressley's going to do a good job, something like that. And I'm getting used to this because every year it just seems like this happens where, guys who you presume would be maybe who had voted for someone else they do the statesman thing and they'll congratulate the guy who won. And I get it to some extent, but like Clint's not in our camp, right? I just want to get your guys' take on that. I'm going off of his whole illegal immigration thing. He hired an illegal immigrant, supported the Dreamers, made a video in support of the Dreamers. And then I think a lot of his stuff on Twitter was scrubbed and stuff. So I don't know exactly what he supported and what he didn't, but everyone I've talked to who either has been a member of his church or has known him for any length of time tells me the same thing, that he's not going to shake things up. He's a company man, and he does lean towards the left. So you guys have any information to either validate that or contradict it?
David, why don't you go first? I've got some stuff, but you may knock it out first.
Yeah, well, it's a couple things to know about Clint Pressley. He's very close with a lot of the platform stalwarts. The guys have been around a long time. Very close with James Merritt. Clint Pressley actually was the one who initiated and was going to bring the cooperation group motion to the floor at last year's SBC. The Merritt motion was originally suggested by Clint Pressley publicly on Twitter, and then he backed out of it. And I guess James Merritt just said, all right, if you're not going to do it, I'll do it myself. And, you know, and it's possible that Clint backed out of that in order to sort of stay out of the fray for running for SBC president this year. I mean, these guys plan this stuff years and years and years in advance. Like Jeff was saying, you know, Dean being groomed maybe for the next one, you know, a couple of years from now or whatever. That's how they do it. They always have a next guy in line, and they always have a guy that's sort of, you know, in the bullpen in case there's a Willie Rice, you know, Deacon Gate fiasco. They always got a Bart Barber in the bullpen that can jump in if necessary to basically be the placeholder.
Yeah, so also on Clint Pressley, good friends with J.D. Greer. He's been a long-term trustee at Southern Seminary, very entrenched in the elite circles of the SBC. When J.D. Greer endorsed Bruce Frank, he said, you know, I'm endorsing Bruce Frank. And that got kind of cut off. Dean next said, but then Clint Pressley would be good too. And so just to kind of add to the hopper, when Tom Askell, I can't remember what the convention was, but after Birmingham, when Resolution 9 passed and it created an uproar about critical race theory, Tom at the next convention stood to ask the messengers to rescind that motion. Clint Pressley was immediately at a mic opposing Tom Askell on this front. I mean, if you don't mind me speculating, this is no inside knowledge. But what I think this represents is a convention that's been in the control of North Carolina and Texas Baptists. You know, North Carolina mostly Aiken and J.D. Greer, Texas aligning with him. I think Clint Pressley is Al Mohler saying, oh, I can use a North Carolina guy to pull Louisville back more in control of the presidency. And so what you actually have there is a guy who's in two institutional camps, and he's not going to do anything contrary.
This is something that I've realized over time, but I think most Southern Baptist laymen do not understand the politics of this because, and I don't even frame it this way most of the time, because I'm thinking in terms of politically left and right. I'm thinking in terms of orthodox versus heterodox, and that's how I approach it. And most of us conservatives, I think we're theologically minded, and that's how we think. However, it's about power, and you have different power centers in the SBC. Al Mohler and Louisville, they were the power center. He was the kingmaker. And a few years ago when he lost the convention bid there, I think that fell. Aiken, and probably even more powerful than Aiken, is Kevin Ezell. Mm-hmm. They really control a lot of messengers and probably call the shots more than Mohler. And so there's been, and multiple insiders have told me this, board members, people in the top echelons of the committees of the SBC, have told me that, basically, yeah, there's been kind of a war between North Carolina and Louisville. And so I appreciate you bringing that out, Jeff. And people need to be aware of this, that when things don't make sense to you, it might be because there are other interests involved and you're just not aware of them. They're not operating on the same, same framework that you're operating on. So,
well, John, if you'll allow me to help your audience on this, I have a popular level understanding of this topic, but I think it's the right paradigm, at least at the popular level. The SBC runs like a Cosa Nostra, like a crime family with different subfamilies within it.
Exactly right.
Who are constantly jockeying against one another for power, prestige, and territory. And that's the paradigm, I think, that best explains SBC institutionalism. And what David's doing there is what I said too. The North American Mission Board is the big funding slush fund. And so they have engaged in real estate speculation, selling property ostensibly for housing missionaries on like furlough. They've started flipping houses. It's given them an incredible nest egg. They dole it out in perks to their loyalists. And again, this has resulted in Al Mohler going up against some of his friends, trying to reassert his sway.
Yeah, not exactly the most encouraging thing, but that is what the reality is. And I remember, one of the former trustees at Southern Seminary telling me that Clint Pressley was totally a company man, never went against Al Mohler, wasn't any help in an actual fight, and totally fine with all the CRT stuff that was being pushed there at Southern Seminary. So he's the president of the Southern Baptist Convention now, so do not expect things to change. And don't go with these guys. Don't go with Colin Smothers and other guys that I'm sure I'll be seeing online on Twitter that are saying that, oh, no, he's actually pretty good. I mean, I remember when there were conservative guys saying, oh, Bart Barber might be pretty good. When it happens every year. Don't buy it. That's just my thing. A few comments here. Dylan says, notice in his response, and I think we're going back now to Brent Leatherwood, he does not respond to the abortion letter. That is true. He skipped over that. Peter Sawyer says the average SBC church member is conservative. I would even say the average SBC pastor, it is these elites. They're the problem. Do you guys still agree with that? I mean, we trot that out every year, and that's kind of what gives people hope of like, well, maybe next year the conservatives will show up because that's who the SBC is. Do you guys believe that still? Or
David, I don't want to be too eager here. Do you want to jump in on that first? I have some
thoughts. Well, generally, I agree with that. But where the rubber meets the road is who can get people to the annual meeting. So it seems like every year somebody brings up, and there was this year as well, somebody bringing up, hey, can we enable remote participation? And the platform knows very well that remote participation is going to shift the entire messenger voting block conservative. So many people who are in small conservative churches, they can't fund messengers out there. They don't show up, whether it's in Anaheim, Indy, wherever it is. They can't travel.
But the folks that work for NAM and the folks that work for the IMB and the folks that work for Lifeway, and of course the big mega churches and things, they can all fund messengers to go and maintain the status quo. So yes, I think your average conservative pastor is more conservative. Certainly your average pew sitter, as I like to call them, is more conservative. But it doesn't make any difference as long as the rules and things like that demand that people are in person voting. That's why it seems like there's that disconnect. There is a disconnect.
Yeah. So this has been, I've been one of those people hoping just what you're saying there, John, for years and years. So here's how I've come to think of it. If your SBC church is older than 40 years, you're probably much more conservative than the elites. If your church is younger than 40 years, you're probably groomed by North American Mission Board funds into platform allegiance because they're the ones flying you in for conferences. They might have helped, you know, pay your pastor salary while you were planting your church, something like that. And so our legacy and heritage SBC churches, much more conservative, unable to travel. Like David just said, this is why remote voting always gets attacked like it's some sort of assault on innocent children because they know what would happen. But it is changing. The SBC is planting left, not just leaning, full-blown leftward congregations, and they're grooming the people who participate towards leftism. And so the younger the church, the more left-leaning or left-committed that you'll find, I think.
Someone asked, John, are you an independent Baptist? I go to an independent Bible church. So, yeah, basically, I was Southern Baptist for a short period of time, went to a SBC seminary. Askell is ignored every time he stands up, says Lisa. And I'm unfortunately, that's probably becoming more and more true. Drew Smith says, SBC doesn't love God. They are concerned with seeing how close they can get to the line of worldliness without stepping over it. That is a sentiment I think a lot of people are feeling. Brian Babe's podcast says, were the people in the room? Yes, both of my guests here were in the room, both Jeff and David. Renaissance of Men, Will Spencer says, I'm just here for the female pastors driving race cars. When does that start? So for those who don't know, the North American Mission Board, it was a race car, huh? They bought it. They had it somehow wheeled in to their booth.
It was a display, just a show.
We can't know, John, because that's one of the things that's sort of low-key terrible about this annual meeting. Even the most small grasp towards financial transparency was, again, treated like an assault on innocent people. And so if they bought and wrapped that IndyCar, we're looking at six digits. If that's a rental and they put a wrap on it, we're looking at 10 digits in terms of cost. Nobody knows. Nobody can know. Dean and Sarah has been on his social media doing apology work for NAB. Oh, no, this was a minimal cost, whatever. That could be true. But guess what? We never will know because they guard their financial documents like it's their lifeblood.
We have David, CRT stupid. William Wolf is claiming that 61% is us. Bullcrap. Danny Aiken is in that 61%. I think he's talking about the law amendment and the 61% who voted for it. I mean, we're in that, but I don't know how much of a sliver we are because he's right that Mueller guys were also in that 61%. Like, this was a super low bar. I know I've said that number of times, but guys who lived through the conservative resurgence, they were pretty much all on board with this. This wouldn't really even contradict your soft complementarians, a lot of them. They would be fine with the law amendment. So such a low bar, and yet we couldn't meet it. So
it's about keeping the spigot on. It's about keeping the money flowing. So, and the cooperation group recommendations that were adopted isn't the same thing. That was the break glassing. That is currently the break glass in case of emergency strategy in case the law amendment passed. So if the law amendment had passed, the fear was now we're going to have hundreds of churches that the credentials committee is going to have to remove from the convention because the Constitution is now clear on this.
Oh, I see.
And so the cooperation group recommendations were basically to say, hey, now the executive committee has a wide berth to change how all of this works in the future. So maybe if the law amendment passes, then the executive committee can say, well, we don't think the credentials committee should have such a role. After all, we want to return the authority to the messengers to decide who's in and who's out. Yeah, which just means that the messengers lose the benefits of the credentials committee actually doing the work to say this church is not in compliance and this church is. You know, if it's on the floor, you have a bunch of messengers saying, I don't know anything about this church. You have somebody from that church behind a mic pleading, we love the convention. We love the convention. We've been here for 40 years, kind of like FBC Alexandria did yesterday. And the thought is, you know, hey, these messengers are too nice. They're not going to kick people out of the convention that love the convention when right. they don't have a recommendation from the credentials committee.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was reading I didn't quite understand the background of that particular recommendation. I think there were four recommendations. And the one that really piqued my interest was it seems like if they wanted to do this over again, so if you had a coalition of conservatives that say, we want to do another law amendment type thing, they would need now two-thirds, not a majority vote. They would need two-thirds off the top to even make this a consideration. Is that correct?
I mean, this is one of those deals that you get from the left that you got to pass the legislation to see how it's going to work, you know? But that seems to be the correct reading on first blush, you know, engaging with the text. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Kyle Nichols says that he heard Presley at the 2024 North Carolina Discipleship Conference, and he does seem like a plant for the SBC establishment to carry out elite's agenda. His issues, stances change with the wind. And he can't help but feel discouraged. And then David, CRT is stupid, says, Kyle, don't feel discouraged. Just leave the SBC. So this is where I want to get your opinions. You guys are both in the SBC. Talk to the people who are SBC or go to SBC churches. What's the deal here? Like, do you leave at this point? When do you leave? If it's not now, is there hope? What do you think?
Well, I'll make a run at that. My church is very well informed about the SBC. We're small, but we participate and we know. And what I find is that I think maybe contrary to some people's expectations, I'm the one with my foot on the brake saying, let's not leave the SBC yet. So the more your church knows about the SBC, if they're conservative, the more they're going to want to be out. I have for a couple of years now been saying if the SBC matters, and it does, it's not essential, but it matters. If it matters enough to the bad guys to want to take it, it matters enough that we should try to stop that. But we're in this situation where I'm calling it the reverse snowball. We do want to get those heritage and legacy Southern Baptist churches in the room because I do think they will vote better if they're properly informed. But every time we have one of these annual meetings, more and more of them find that the last straw and they bail out. And so the pool of helpful voters is constantly diminishing. And this close to the defeat of the law amendment and whatnot, you know, last time I was on your podcast talking about the SBC, John, I was pretty rowdy. I'm still rowdy, but I have more questions now about whether we could ever actually marshal the numbers needed to bring meaningful reform. That's a major question for me, you know, 4 or 5 hours after the law amendment is defeated.
And you might feel different tomorrow. And
maybe.
But yeah, it's a discouraging day from that standpoint. David, what do you think about staying in the SBC versus leaving?
Well, we have, I mean, members at my church that I've talked to over the past few years that basically, I mean, they're on all sides. So I have some that are saying, well, why are we even part of this for numerous reasons? And then others that are saying, if we leave the SBC, I'm going to another church. And so and those are the older folks. You know, like our church has been SBC since the 60s, like since its inception. And so we got older folks that are second, third generation SBC that are saying if we get out of the SBC, we're leaving. So the challenge on the doctrinal end is to help people understand that it's okay and possible to be Baptist, to be convictionally Baptist by practice and doctrine and tradition without being in the Southern Baptist Convention. Once that hurdle is over, now we can start talking about what is the pragmatic benefit or, you know, the benefit to this church of cooperating in this way, because there's nothing wrong in and of itself with voluntary cooperation. The SBC is it's a parachurch ministry, cooperation between other churches. But when you get to the point where with a good conscience, you can't continue to partner with people that are manifestly disobeying scripture, that's where the rubber meets the road at the local church. And, you know, I think that we underestimate, you know, we talk about sometimes in secular politics how we can see politicians that hold the purse strings being able to buy votes by doling out that money to voters and things like that. I think we underestimate how much that happens in an institution as big as the SBC. how many people are voting who are financially dependent on the whole thing and very unlikely to vote for anything, even for doctrine they might believe in, that would rock that boat or compromise or put at risk their financial situation and their jobs. And yeah, so the status quo has so much gravity in the SBC.
Yeah, you know, the year that they should have probably done the online voting was 2020, and they just skipped the whole entire convention without really any precedent. Or, well, they say they had a precedent because, what was it, like decades before, there was one convention that was skipped during like World War II or something. I can't remember. But, you know, it's just like, if it's not going to be that year, I don't see that happening ever. And you have to win the room. And it just seems like that's impossible at this point. Maybe we had a window of opportunity 2018, 2019, 2021, maybe. I don't know. But that window seems to be closing, as Jeff said, more and more churches keep leaving. So Brian Babes did $2 say, why wasn't the ballot vote on law, Mike Law, shut down? So I'm not sure exactly what she means by that, Jeff.
Yeah, I'll make a run at that. So I wish we did more ballot voting because it would be more objective. A lot of the non-ballot voting is just, and this happened twice in this annual meeting, a room that looks very close to 50-50, Bart just declares a side that wins according to his preferences. And so if you ask me, I wish we did more ballot voting. It takes more time. People don't want to take the time to do it. So we're left with that. So again, I mentioned this earlier, I naively thought that the ballot vote was going to work in our favor. That's why none of us opposed it, because we thought it would reflect the previous vote last year that would document, hey, 90 something percent of SBC annual meeting members, a 12,000 person body voted overwhelmingly in favor of the law amendment. What I've since found out is that there was a lot of closeted egalitarian and egalitarian sympathetic and institutional sympathetic men who would be happy to vote in private differently than they would in public. So, you know, I think I actually represent some of the hardline conservatives in SBC, and I think most of us were happy for the ballot vote at the time, sweet summer children that we were in those days.
It's funny, you know, Russell Fuller has stories of guys who he knows personally in the SBC who were on the other side of the conservative resurgence who are still working in the SBC. And at prominent seminaries, I can't really name, I'm thinking of one name in particular at Southeastern that he hasn't given me permission to share, but, you know, he, you know, was sitting next to this guy and looked over his shoulder and saw, it was, I think a, they were voting on something like egalitarianism. This was back, you know, in the early 90s. And he noticed that this guy was on the other side of it. And yet, you know, still employed in the SBC. And so, you know, how many of those guys are there? I don't know. But it's this vote makes it seem like there's a whole lot more of these guys than we realize. And a lot of posers, not exactly a vote of confidence there. All right. Well, I appreciate it. We've been going over an hour. And I know David needs to go catch his flight. And you guys have been very gracious in giving me your time and informing Southern Baptists who are concerned out there. Thank you for that. If people want to check out Jeff's stuff, I guess, what, Twitter, Jeff? Is that the best place?
Yeah, merely J. Wright, SBC Underground. And we're also looking to start looking at alternatives. And so we formed a group called Credo Alliance, looking for a home for Southern Baptists who don't think they have a home in the Southern Baptist Convention anymore. So any of those things would be a way to connect with me.
All right. And protestia.com for David's writings on this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we'll have a write-up about this later for sure.
All right. Well, God bless you guys. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, brother.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.